Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, David. It is certainly a pleasure to have you today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I think you and I have figured out before that we hit the record button, you and I have many mutual friends in the fundraising space. We've never been in the room together. This is our first meaningful conversation. I think so far we're doing pretty good. Let's hear who you are. Tell us who you are.
David Langiuli. I live here in Southwest Florida. We were sharing our locales before the start of the podcast. And I work with leaders, as you do, in the nonprofit world. We mostly focus, our brand is called Fundraising Leadership, and we focus on the leadership part of that for the most part. We really are up to supporting leaders in the nonprofit world through executive coaching and training. And I have some partners in this endeavor, Janice Cunning up in Toronto, and Michelle Malloy-Dillon, and Margaret Katz-Kahn in Boulder, Colorado. So among the four of us, we've got quite a bit of swath of North America covered.
Yeah, David, I have to imagine. So I know the Toronto market a little bit, and I certainly know Boulder a little bit as well. Those are probably two thoughtful places, and then you're from South Florida. So does that make for some very thoughtful, contemplative sort of people who know how to think well? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, think, and we have – the four of us all have somewhat different leadership styles.
Yeah.
So that does make for very interesting conversation, shall we say. And we like to work with leaders in the nonprofit world, as you do, who have different styles and different challenges and different missions. And one of the reasons why Janice and I co-founded this small partnership 5 years ago was because we love the fact that leaders in the nonprofit world are driven by purpose and passion. And yes, fundraisers in particular also are out there and driven by raising money for that purpose and passion. So we love that too. Yeah.
So, David, I think the subject, so we've had, we broadcast a little over 200 episodes at this point, and we have just turned the corner on 2021. And
Happy New Year to us and the audience.
Yes, happy. Yes. I have to admit, we have not talked about mental health a whole lot. You have just recently written a book that I want to get some that I have had some time to look at, and I want to hear a little bit about what your thoughts are about how do we as nonprofit leaders, fundraising professionals, really sort of tee up this new year in a way that sort of readies ourselves for what may not necessarily be full recovery, but we can at least say we got 2020 behind us. What's your thoughts on that? How can we really make sure that fundraisers are really sort of starting off the new year? Just like your book says, you know, in peace and tranquility, how can we sort of really get that started off the right way?
Well, the subtitle of the book is "You Got to Get Your Mind Right." And that's a line from, 1960s film, Cool Hand Luke.
Yes.
Which made Paul Newman, that was his breakthrough movie. Great film, by the way, for the audience. I think you can fire it up on any of the streaming platforms. Highly recommend it. But in terms of mental health, we like to use the word mental fitness as opposed to mental health, primarily because mental health has sort of a connotation of like there's something wrong or broken or fixed or that needs fixing. And in some cases, if you have a serious mental health problem, that may be the case that you need, you know, serious attention, medical intervention. That's not what we're here to talk about, and that's not what I talk about in the book. What we talk about, generally speaking, is mental fitness. And since we're at the start of the new year, it's a great time. It's a great metaphor. You know, a lot of folks make physical fitness resolutions in the new year. And many of those resolutions crap out or fall by the wayside, to use a more technical term, crapped out by about the third week in January. And so what we believe is that just like physical fitness, mental fitness takes practice. And there are ways that we sabotage ourselves, even from doing the things that we know will be good for us, whatever that is, professionally or personally. And so my partners and I got involved with some work called positive intelligence during the lockdown and during COVID. Sure. It's very powerful work based on a book, another book by a gentleman by the name of Shirzad Shamin called Positive Intelligence. It was a New York Times bestseller many years ago. And we've developed some training, some fitness training. It's like having a personal trainer and going to the gym, the mental fitness gym, so that you develop the mental muscles to stay fit. It takes about 7 weeks really to develop those practices and skills. And so anyway, that's, I'm happy to expand on this a bit more with you in the audience. But really the focus is to notice how we sabotage ourselves and then create a framework for being sort of more wise and more agile and more powerful in how we go about our work.
Is there, so I have not done a whole lot of writing about this. I said, we probably haven't talked a lot about this on the podcast, but I've probably several times, David, alluded to this. Is there something in your mind, sort of, will be junior theorist here, we'll sort of theorize for a moment. Is there something about fundraising professionals in the nonprofit work that makes us particularly prone to having a need for mental fitness, as you describe it.
Yes.
Because, you know, I think about my work. I tend to think I'm a pretty mentally fit sort of guy, but in fact, sometimes that mental fitness is actually sometimes perhaps what gets me in trouble. I don't know. That's, I tend to be the guy who oftentimes feels like I'm ruffling feathers, and I'm thinking those feathers are a little, there's a sensitivity that we tend to have in this line of work. What is that in your mind?
Yeah. So we call that the unwillingness to ruffle feathers, even though you are aware of it and you like to do it. But many fundraising leaders we work with have a saboteur that we call a pleaser. It's actually quite common in the nonprofit world.
Well, you have a personality for it.
Oh, yeah. There are nine of these different saboteurs, we call them. They are behaviors as opposed to like an aspect of your personality. They're more behaviors And then there's something we call the judge, which is the master saboteur, the way we sort of judge ourselves critically. We call that the inner critic. You know, we judge circumstances as right or wrong, or we judge people as good or bad, you know. So anyway, this behavioral pattern we see a lot of in nonprofit leaders. One of them is called the pleaser, and it's this desire to always, and you might expect this, especially with fundraisers, right?
Sure.
Always wanting to please.
Yeah.
Except when you always want to please and you don't want to ruffle feathers and you want to make everyone happy, what do you think the impact of that is, Jason?
Well, we're always sort of taking in that negative energy or that negative vibe sort of on our part. I remember one of the things I am working on that immediately comes to mind as you're talking about pleasing. I get very frustrated when my guests sometimes talk about fundraising through the lens of sort of consumer behavior or consumer sciences, as if our donors are one and the same with being customers. And I remember back when I was in college, I worked at, you know, at a big, large Sears department store. And it was the idea, you know, the customer is always right. Well, the customer is always right sort of ties in really well with your pleaser, I have to imagine.
Right. True.
And so we don't, we haven't seemed to be able to get the relationship right with the donor in such a way where sometimes the donor doesn't need to be pleased.
Correct. That's exactly right.
You
know,
you and I could be in a, it's just like the relationship I have with my children or the relationship I have with my wife or with a good friend or you and I even, you know, it's the idea that we may not have to 100% please each other all the time. There can be some tension and some banter. And sometimes that's what keeps the relationship going is what I guess.
Be disagreement.
Yeah,
it can be conflict, actually, you know.
Yes.
And so my wife has a very – and she's been through this program also. She I was not coaching it when she went through it, but one of my partners did, and she has a very strong – but we knew this already. She had already taken the assessment. By the way, for the audience, there's a free assessment they can take if they go to positiveintelligence.com, and they can just take the saboteur assessment and see if they have a pleaser. It'll look at scored on a 0 to 10 scale on each of these saboteurs. But the pleaser, and I see this with my wife and I see this with my coaching clients that have this behavioral pattern, is they get exhausted. They just get exhausted mentally and physically because they're always trying to please everyone. You know, and you know the old saying, you know, you can please some of the people some of the time, but you cannot please all of the people all of the time. And that is very discouraging for people who have this behavioral pattern. They just get frustrated and exhausted.
So when you get to the word exhaustion, I tend to immediately start to diagnose or anticipate burnout, which is certainly something that we talk about in fundraising a lot, too. And I have to imagine, if I'm connecting the dots, I'll let you connect the dots for us. When you get to that point of exhaustion, David, I have to imagine that some of these other behaviors start to you become much more prone to let some of these other characteristics that may not be particularly common, but you probably open up the door for all these other behavioral patterns. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. The saboteurs love to kick you when you're down.
Right.
They do.
Work in teams and teams of three and four. Yeah.
Yeah. They'll pile on. Yeah. They're usually exactly. the judge will, you know, my inner critic, I've been working on that for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years now. And it still will come up and beat me up when I'm down. You know, I'll criticize myself. In fact, I'm doing some separate work in this, along this line with a group of people. It's just based on mindful self-compassion, like having compassion for ourselves when things are tough. But when you're exhausted, when you're burnt out, these saboteurs will raise their ugly heads even more. One of the other patterns that we see a lot of in any leaders, but especially with leaders in the nonprofit world and fundraising leaders, is this desire to control everything. We call it the controller. Okay. You know, you want to control outcomes. You want to control. Boy, that can be another exhausting thing, especially last year. You know, plan for meetings, and when the meeting doesn't go the way you want, that can be very discouraging.
David, is there one of these behavioral patterns that is very characteristic? One of the issues that I take with fundraising is what I call this arm's length fundraising. It's this pattern of organizational pattern where we deliberately design our fundraising strategies that deliberately maintain a distance from our donors. So whether we're using direct mail, special events, grant writing, online fundraising, whatever, if you look at the common thread with all of those fundraising methods, they deliberately maintain distance.
Yep.
With the donor. Yep. Is there a particular, I could certainly say that as a pleaser, you can only handle so much, but is there any?
No, that's not the one that keeps smaller nonprofits from doing what it's called, the avoider. We call it the avoider. They are avoiding intimacy with people. And that's why it's sabotaging behavior. Like, it's a protective, the avoider wants to protect ourselves from getting hurt, or, you know, there's always something good. By the way, this is why we call these things saboteurs. There's always something good. Look, planning and organizing, right? There's good in that. Pleasing people, being pleasant, for example, being pleasant is a good thing.
Yeah.
And avoiding hazards or avoiding people who might do harm to you is actually a protective behavior, except when it gets overexpressed, when any of these things become overexpressed. In the case of the avoider, is we're going to avoid having any intimate relationships with individuals because that could be dangerous.
And I just finished a book, David. This is where I've got all these concepts that are rolling around in my head right now because it's fresh, working on a book project. But it's this idea of early specialization. I just finished a book by an author, David Epstein, wrote a book called Range, and he talks about early specialization. And it would seem to me, early specialization is the idea that you get into a line of work where you specialize too early. And ours tends to be, in my opinion, our line of work tends to be one of those areas where you can very quickly become a specialist far too quickly. But what it also does is it tends to specialize us in these areas where perhaps these behavioral weaknesses that you're describing sort of manifest themselves. And so you could actually spend your entire career what I consider to be sort of a subpar level of performance and not necessarily reaching your potential, and also sort of sitting or, you know, wearing yourself out all the time. Am I right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm mindful that you have your CFRE, as I recall. Yeah, sure. Yeah. And so, and I don't, but my understanding, and maybe you could share with the audience, my understanding of that program, and it's very rigorous, as I've heard, is to actually expand your range as a fundraiser beyond whatever specialization you may, because different people come into the profession through different routes. They might come in annual giving. They might come in direct mail. They might come in, as I did, in major gifts. Sure. But I think I like what you're saying. If you stay, this is an opinion, I believe that especially fundraising leaders need to have range.
Yes.
Even if they are not expert in all of these specialties, having range can give perspective for a fundraising team, or if you're an executive director, having some range so that you know how to hire the right people, you know what questions to ask. So there is a bit of what we might call expert's fallacy, right? You become an expert in one slice of fundraising, and then all of a sudden you believe that you know everything about everything, except you don't know shit from shinola.
And that's what he talks about. And I feel, Epstein talks about this in his book. He's saying that you can become a specialist in like what I would call arm's length fundraising just in a couple of years. And that has been some of my critique. I've had guests on here advocating for the CFRE and other credentials that we offer in our space. Mm-hmm. And the CFRE is certainly one of those where I feel like perhaps we plateau, and then it sort of it's a maintaining credential, right? is what I have often said. It doesn't necessarily continuously push us to yet another level of expertise or performance. And so bringing this back to bringing this back to these behavioral patterns and this idea of mental fitness. If I'm sitting in this particular area of expertise and specialty that has made me very comfortable and allowed me to sort of maintain this level of I'm okay with this idea that I'm a pleaser, or I'm okay that I'm an avoider.
Right.
It now becomes especially painful, does it not, David? That it becomes a mental health issue.
It does.
Not just a professional development issue. When I say for example, I've spent the last 5 years, first 5 years of my career doing direct mail. Mm-hmm. And then a guy like me comes in here and says, look, I think you'd be a rock star, soliciting donors across a lunch table doing major gifts. But to push them that way is to not only mess with them professional,
You're starting to mess with their saboteurs, yes, and their saboteurs. Yes. It's a defense.
I'm like a monster to them, right?
I know.
It's not just a professional development exercise. You're making it sound like I need some better skills as a therapist or something.
Yes and no. I mean, I think I like the work of Carol Dweck. You may be familiar with this work around very growth mind. Yeah, growth mindset. So what the saboteurs will do is keep you in your lane. They want to keep you in your lane.
Yeah.
And because they have this protective, aspect to them. And they will tell you lies about how avoiding one-on-one meetings with donors, you'll be safer if you just stay in your lane and do direct mail. That it will be a saboteur lie. That is a lie.
Yeah.
Okay. And if you have a growth mindset, so this is the people we work with, and I'm sure you're getting more into organizations where you're consulting and you're encountering people, maybe not with the growth. And people who come to us already have a growth mindset because they know, we're going to rock their world a little bit, and they're okay with the discomfort of growth. There is always discomfort with growth. Like even in this mental fitness program, actually, it's designed to make people uncomfortable. They get uncomfortable during the 7 weeks of this training. Like going to the gym, if you haven't been to the gym in a year, man, you're going to be sore as hell. Right. It's going to be uncomfortable. It just is, right? So doing anything new, change is uncomfortable. And the saboteur will tell you a lie that you'll be safer if you just avoid, if you just avoid that. Or you'll be better off if you just keep pleasing people. Like never tell them something they don't want to hear. You'll be better off. Don't ever tell a donor anything that, like, let's just say your nonprofit made a mistake. Oh, don't ever tell a donor that.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Except they can smell that a mile away. It's completely inauthentic. Yeah.
I was sitting with a client right before the holiday. Now this is actually, gosh, COVID sort of puts this time. We forget where this was probably more than almost a year ago. I was sitting with a client who had not done a leader that works for the organization that's a client, and I'm sitting there talking. He's in the meeting that we're having with a major donor, and I deliberately use tension. It's this idea of tension that you're familiar with, and tension is a very helpful. I have always found it to be a very helpful tool early in cultivating a relationship with a major donor, so as to sort of find out if they're really there with you, or are they in this. Are they committed to this? And also to identify opportunities about, okay, so where might this go and what sort of interest might you have? There were two colleagues there, these two gentlemen, the younger gentleman, the less experienced individual that I was there largely to coach, was very comfortable with the tension. And where I'm getting with this, David, is the question of sometimes these saboteurs are your boss.
Right.
Am I right? It's a member of the team who has that pleasing personality or that avoiding personality, that tendency.
Correct. So what will happen in teams is that, and we're just actually, this work, so this mental fitness work, positive intelligence work, is very intimate in that you're sharing information with your teammates that could be used against you in a court of law. Now, I'm just, unless you have high trust on the team to begin with, we would not recommend teams going through this. Now, that being said, we are working with an intact team of 6 people and bringing them through this program together because they each have different saboteurs. Now, we've already debriefed this with them. They've already taken the assessment and they're willing to do the work together because they know. Because what happens with these saboteurs or these behavioral patterns is they will start to collude with one another. They will collude. So if you have an avoider on the team and a pleaser on the team and a controller on the team, guess what's going to happen?
Oh, my. Sounds like a bomb or something.
Yeah. Like you're never going to venture out. You're like this idea of tension. You would never want to create tension because with a donor in a conversation, because that could be uncomfortable. So you avoid it. That you're out of control if you create tension. Or how could you be pleased? You have to please the donor. So you can't be, they won't even like allow themselves to be the grit of sand, one grit of sand in an oyster that creates a pearl. Right?
Right.
No, we can't have any grit.
Right.
Yeah, it's just so, yes, doing this work with teams so that we could create what we would call a mentally fit team or a team with positive intelligence so they can see how. And then, of course, we introduce the opposite of these saboteurs called the sage powers. So this is when you start. Yeah, we start. This is where the sage powers are are like superpowers that we all have, but we forget that we have, like things like having empathy for ourselves and others. Like that's a sage power. Or taking action, powerful action, right? The avoider wants to avoid taking powerful action.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jedi warriors, when you ever see them, right? This has the idea of peace and tranquility, right? When you watch Star Wars, I'm a big fan of the films, and probably everyone in your audience has seen at least one Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
In the great risk and chaos, they take laser-focused action, even when they know they don't know what the outcome will be. Yeah. That's a sage power. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So going back to this, let's settle here before I let you go. But I want to sit on this sort of this avoider person, this avoider.
Yeah. I'm going to avoid your question, Jason.
let's sit on that one for a minute, because that one I think is the most limiting. That in my mind, for a lot of my listeners, is perhaps one of the more limiting. So what is the sage? What is the other side of that?
So the first thing is to notice that you're avoiding.
Yeah.
So that's the first in this process, is to notice, oh, I'm avoiding whatever it is because of the potential pain that may be involved. Could be just the discomfort of growth, as we were talking about earlier. Like, yeah. I don't want to go and meet with a donor because that could be a great meeting, but there's like, you make up a story like that could be uncomfortable, right? Yeah. So first is to notice, I'm avoiding this meeting with a donor, even though I know it would be good for me and my growth. Jason says this donor is ready to be spoken to, but I'm avoiding it. So the first thing is to notice, oh, my avoider is here.
Yes.
All right, I'm avoiding. The next step, I think, is always to just have some compassion for yourself and just say, this is hard for me. Like, I have this behavioral pattern of avoiding. It's just something that has developed over time. It comes from a good place. So I think that's the empathize power. That's what we call the sage power of just empathize. Like, this is hard for me right now. This has been hard for other people. I'm not alone here. Other people like me have been confronted, you know, have avoid stuff, or, you know, have tried to take this step and step back from the abyss. And then you can, I would say, in this particular case, you could do some brainstorming with colleagues. Like, we call that the innovate power, right? You could start to innovate. Like, how might I approach this donor? What was it like for you when you first met with your first donor? Like, just so, and then you could activate. You could just say, okay, I'm going to set this appointment and I'm going to go forward, even though this is uncomfortable for me. So those are some of the ways you can, this is one example of the way you can neutralize a behavioral pattern that is ingrained and is there to protect you. And you also know that it's limiting you. Yeah, those would be some ways. And we train this. This is not easy.
Yeah, to do. I mean, this is a very powerful coaching framework. I can see how. So the avoider is that person, I'm guessing, is that person who oftentimes is fearful of rejection.
Yes,
which is the sort of the dark side of what I think is oftentimes some of what are highly we hire fundraising professionals who are notably friendly, outgoing, highly engaging type people, but then they oftentimes have this dark side, mm-hmm. Sort of this implicit motive to avoid
and to please. By the way, The yes, same, right? Please, you please all the time because you don't want to be rejected.
Yeah,
of course.
And what I've oftentimes said to supervisors is you're sitting there at a board meeting talking with your colleagues and frustrated because this direct report of yours won't get out there and solicit money, but that rejection cue, that fear of rejection pops up at the point at which they're fearful of just getting the meeting. Right. It's the same sort of mental block. Yes. Am I right? It's the same mental block to say, David, can we have a meeting, as to say, David, will you consider writing a, you know, significant gift to our organization? It's that same underlying fear of messing up the relationship.
So there, if there's a saboteur present, whether it's avoider and pleaser, I would say those would be two that would be, there's an underlying fear. And the fear of rejection could be one of them. So there's, you know, you avoid and you please so that you are not, because you're afraid that you'll be rejected and the hurt. And so, again, it's helpful to notice, I am avoiding this situation because I am afraid of being. So that's the first thing, is to just confront yourself. Yeah. Like, there's a fear here. I'm afraid of this. And then have empathy. Like, it's okay. This is hard. Like, this is I'm afraid of being rejected. It's like a lot of people, I'm not alone. A lot of people are afraid. Like, it's not pleasant to be rejected. It just isn't. And then you can, once you accept this, that there's nothing wrong here. Like, it's okay to feel that feeling. Then you can shift to these other ways of being, which is, I could take some small action. Like, first, I can reach out and set an appointment. That would be like one small action I could take. Yeah. And if I get the appointment and I haven't been rejected, like, wow. Now, life doesn't always turn out that way. So we also train people to look for gifts, like when you do get rejected. Now, this is a bit harder to do. This is more like a advanced Jedi training, is looking for the gifts. Like, sometimes, and this is hard for people to realize when they're feeling rejected, is like, we call it mining for the gifts. Like, okay, what's the gift here? You got to look for it. What's the gift here? Sometimes the gifts aren't immediately apparent. You learn 1 year later that this donor was arrested on a felony grand theft auto. Right. Right. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I see the gift now. Right. Right. Sometimes you don't see the gift for a year. But you have to be willing to have that perspective.
David, yeah. We have you've given us some fascinating things to think about. We've had our listeners' attention for about 35 minutes, and this is a point at which oftentimes we lose some of them. I want to remind everyone that the book, A Life with Peace and Tranquility, Getting Your Mind Right, is available on Amazon. David, if somebody's listening to us and they want to have a meaningful conversation, they know how to find me, but perhaps they want to find you. How would you suggest that they do that?
They can find me on LinkedIn, David Langiuli, or they can navigate over to fundraisingleadership.org, and they can learn about what we do from coaching and training. Either way, I'm happy to have the conversation, and I truly enjoyed this one, Jason.
Yeah, and David, one of the ways that oftentimes when I talk to guys like you who provide coaching and other types of similar services, who is that person that perhaps is listening today that you're most interested in hearing from? So if somebody's sort of squirming in their seat and they know that we've talked about, they know that they're that personality, they struggle with some of the things we've talked about today. Mm-hmm. Who is that person you most want to hear from?
Yeah, we love to hear from folks, mid-career fundraising leaders, mid-career, who are up to something in the world. They are willing to get... They're willing to be comfortable with discomfort.
Yes.
Yeah. And those are the folks we love, the people who want to learn and grow. And as we say, venture out onto the skinny branches of life, where things get exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there was probably a huge cohort between listening to our conversation today and reading the stuff that guys like you and I and our colleagues write. I think there is a cohort of people who are thinking very carefully and critically about the work that we do, and those might be the types that would be inclined to reach out to you, don't you think?
Yes, and I want to leave you with, an invitation, Jason. I'm looking forward to your book. And when it comes out, we want to have you on the Fundraising Leadership Podcast.
Sure. Yeah. Forgive me for not asking you about that. So that podcast is the Fundraising Leadership Podcast. And yes. You have a couple of colleagues that are on that with you as well.
Yeah, we focus on topics related to fundraising, leadership, management, and coaching. Those are our topics. We do about 24 of those a year. We're not quite as prolific as you are, and we love to have guests like you and others from the nonprofit world who are interested in those four topic areas. And folks, if they like this conversation and they like your podcast, it's just another one. We've been at it now for 4 years on the podcast. So if you're interested in those topics, fundraising, leadership, coaching, or management, we always have lots of guests. You can reach out to me or Janice or Margaret or Michelle.
Fascinating. David, it has certainly been a pleasure. You're always welcome back. Certainly extend that invitation to your colleagues.
Thank you.
If you're listening today, you're always welcome on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. All you got to do is have a big idea or bold opinion about the fundraising profession. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.